History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week marks another significant anniversary, one that a few decades ago was something the majority of Americans were aware of and recognized the significance of. In today's world, that percentage would undoubtedly be much lower, but maybe we can pump it up a bit over the next hour. I'm talking about VJ Day, Victory Over Japan Day, August 14th, 78 years ago this week. After 4 years of war for America and 6 years for the world, the most devastating and deadly conflict in human history saw hostilities come to an end, with Emperor Hirohito announcing his intent to surrender, something he would follow through on a couple of weeks later aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. But there's so much more to that story, and we'll hear some different perspectives on it today. If you were alive 78 years ago, perhaps you remember just how much the news of victory meant. It was certainly palpable in New York's Times Square, where NBC's Ben Grauer delivered some pretty picturesque play-by-play over some of these very same radio airwaves you may be tuned into right now.
This is the NBC mobile unit in the heart, center, and the pulsing focus of a joyous nation on Times Square in New York City. Ben Grauer reporting as I stand, literally stand, tiptoe, sticking my head outside the silver gray turret top of the NBC mobile unit and look uptown over a foaming, seething, writhing mass of faces lifted joyously and buoyantly and gloriously happy at the final conclusion of a desperate war which has seen its closing days in a desperate day or three or four of anxiety, turmoil, anticipation, doubt, fear, and being cast down. Are these people happy? That's the only word to express it.
They were happy in the States, but so many Americans were still overseas on VJ Day, including thousands and thousands who'd been preparing for the invasion of Japan. Among them, a former All-American swimmer at Yale who would go on to become the first Navy SEAL to reach the rank of admiral. Dick Lyon was a young frogman scouting out potential landing spots for invasion forces when the war came to a close.
Off we went to Japan, and I did another recon on a beach in a little city on Honshu, the big island, actually a village, really. Same thing, good beach. Having gone in, done the beach, and was ready to come out and be picked up by my LCVP, the Landing Craft, and get back onto the APA. And I noticed that the little city, as you might expect, right at the end of the war, little village looked deserted. I mean, really, nobody. And as I looked, I observed three men, elderly, I could tell, my face mask on top of my head by that point, and I'm looking, and they came right down to the edge of the water, and I'm in the water up to about my shoulders, and I looked at them, and they looked at me. The man in the middle said, "I can see what you have just completed doing, and I understand what is happening. It's easy to see that a landing will take place relatively small, and I presume that this is being done all over our homeland. I want you to know that we will cooperate in any way that we can to make this peaceful and help in any way that we can to be sure that there are no additional casualties. And would you please be sure to pass this word to your superiors so that they know that there will be no opposition whatsoever." And of course, I was just astounded that, wait a minute, all in perfect English? I thought, after a pause, I said, "I certainly will do that. And by the way," he said, "well, I must let you know, I achieved my undergraduate baccalaureate degree from Harvard University. I couldn't let that one go. And then I just paused for literally 5 or 10 seconds, saying nothing. And I just looked at him, didn't say anything. And then I said, well, I have to tell you, I'm a Yalie. And we used to kick Harvard butt regularly on the football field. We both laughed, and as it turned out, he invited me to join, he and his wife, and I ran it by my boss, who said, this is a golden opportunity for you. He, by all means, go in, have dinner with them, and enjoy. He said, in whatever way, I think he's kind of is the leader of what's left in this little place, and we need that cooperation. So I did that, and I went in armed with 2 cartons of Lucky Strike cigarettes. They were more than gold bars. They were, and he was just delighted to receive those. And after dinner, I got back to get my way back on the APA. And as I was leaving, he said, I want you to have this. And he handed me a portfolio of 23 applique pictures, if you will, done by hand, applique, and then in the characters on the pictures, a story of how each of those persons became a samurai warrior. And so those samurai warriors are now adorning the wall behind me. You look right over my shoulder. You can see those, and I got those in 1945. My uniform was a pair of swim trunks and swim fins. Underwater demolition teams became known in the Navy as frogmen.
That was the late Admiral Dick Lyon. After he retired from the Navy, he entered politics, and for 8 years they called him mayor of Oceanside, California. For Jerry Yellen, the last fighter pilot is a moniker he often heard. That was the title of one of his books, focusing on the mission he flew in his P-51 Mustang on August 14, 1945. When he returned from that mission, the war was over, but one of his best friends, his wingman, Phil Schlomberg, had been killed in action. Yellen spent his final years as an outspoken advocate for the Spirit of 45 campaign, hoping that every year at this time, American leaders of the future might draw inspiration from accounts of the spirit of unity and shared belief that existed in our country back then.
My wish for the Spirit of 45 is to reach out to all the young people in America, to make our stories known of what made us the greatest generation. We served, 16 million of us served, 10% of the population, but the other 90% were at war also. We had an identifiable enemy. Japan was our enemy. Germany declared war on America. We never declared war on Germany, but that made the war, Germany and Japan. And after it was over, the leaders of America rebuilt Japan and rebuilt Germany so that we have allies of those who were formerly enemy. In 1988, my youngest son, a 4-son, married the daughter of a kamikaze pilot in Japan. And I have 3 Japanese grandchildren. They mean as much to me as my 3 American grandchildren.
When your son had proposed to his wife, she had to talk to her father, because her father was a Japanese fighter pilot in World War II, right?
Yes, he was a kamikaze pilot. He had 4 or 5 hours in a zero, and his whole class of flymates, of classmates, were sent into the war as kamikaze pilots, but he and one other guy were sent to China, and he survived the war. In 1983, I was asked by the Mitsui Bank Group to go to Japan, talk about real estate in America. I was a consultant to the major banks in San Diego and San Francisco. And I didn't want to go in 1983. Japan was not a place I visit, and Japanese weren't human beings. They weren't people. But my wife wanted to go, so we went to Japan. And I immediately fell in love with the culture, the food, the people. So when we came back in 1983, we offered a homestay program to our youngest son, who was a senior in college. He graduated from college in 1984. Didn't know what he wanted to do, so he took a job teaching English for 1 year. Now it's 2014, and he hasn't come back yet. In 1987, we went to Japan, and I met a young lady, and Robert said that he wanted to get married to her. And I saw the faces of the 16 guys that were killed that I knew in my squadron. And I wondered what they would think, but it was not my life. It was his life that was important. And I asked him, what does her father say? And he said, he won't meet me. And 7 months later, the father did meet my son. And he had full beard, bushy hair. And the father asked him just 5 questions. How old is your father? 63. Was he in the war? Yes. What did he do? He's a pilot. What did he fly? He said, P-51s. He said, where? Over Japan. And he went home, said to his wife, make the wedding. And she said, why? We hate them. And he said, any man that could fly a P-51 against the Japanese and live must be a brave man. And I want the blood of that man to flow through the veins of our grandchildren. So I have 3 grandchildren in Japan. And we went there in September of 2012 to talk to them as adults. My oldest grandson's name is Kentaro. We call him Ken. And he has a job. He just graduated from the Hokkaido University, which is the technical school similar to MIT, as a physicist with a master's degree in physics, and was one of 20,000 applicants for 100 jobs. And he got one of the 100 jobs. His brother last year graduated from the University of City of London, a 4-year course in 3 years as a philosopher. And the last 2 years of the school, he studied in Latin, which was the language spoken by the ancient philosophers. And when he graduated on the dean's list, got an A+ on his dissertation, and was awarded a 2 years master's program scholarship at Oxford. So he just started Oxford University. So I guess that other guy, the other father, knew something that I didn't know, and it happens to be right. It turned out he was right. And then I have a 17-year-old granddaughter. We don't know what she's going to do, but the 2 boys are absolutely outstanding.
But neither one of them would be here if both their grandfathers hadn't survived World War II.
That's true. I met, for the first time, a member of Phil Schlomberg's family. Phil Schlomberg was my wingman, who was killed on August 14th, 1945, on the last mission flown over World War II.
And you guys were P-51s, and he was a good friend of yours and was flying on your wing, but he had somewhat of a premonition about that mission, didn't he?
Phil Schlomberg, we were briefing on August 13th, and somebody asked, why are we going there? They dropped 2 bombs, the war's over. And Jim Tapp was our then CO, and he said, we have to keep them honest. And Schlomberg leaned over and he said, Captain, if we go, I'm not coming back. And I looked at him and said, what are you talking about? He says, it's a feeling I have. So I told Tapp that story, and he said the only person to get him off is Doc Lewis, if Schlomberg agrees to go see him. And he didn't want to see him. He says, I'll go. On the morning of the 14th, I said, just stick on my wing. They're going to broadcast the code word Ohio before we ever get to the target. Nobody heard the code word. We got to where we have to drop our exterior tanks. We dropped the tanks. We went in and strafed airfields around Tokyo. We were getting shot at, I know. You could see the tracers. But when somebody had only 90 gallons of gas left, we needed 90 gallons to get back to Iwo Jima. They called in 90 gallons. And I'm leading a flight of four, and leading my flight of four through some clouds towards the B-29 that's going to navigate us back to Iwo Jima. When I came out of the clouds, Schlomberg was gone. There was no radio contact, no visible contact. And he was the last guy killed in World War II. While we were strafing Japan, they declared the war over. And it was 3 hours before we got back. So he was really the last man killed on a mission of hostility towards the Japanese on August 14th, 1945. Phil Schlomberg graduated from university at the age of 16 and entered the Air Corps at the age of his 18th. And he took the IQ test, and his IQ test score was the highest ever scored of any of the 16 million of us that entered World War II. He was bright and brilliant and a good pilot. And he knew he was going to die, refused not to go, and went and was killed.
One of more than 406,000 Americans who paid the ultimate price for the victory that was secured 78 years ago this week. Jerry Yellen was a fighter pilot in the air on VJ. Before we're done today, we'll hear from a pilot of the last bomber to drop its bombs on the last bombing mission of World War II. But when we come back, who could be more elated by news of the war's end than those who spent most of it in captivity? We'll get some POW perspectives on VJ Day when this special episode of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special VJ Day edition marking 78 years since World War II came to a close. What a relief it was to men, women, and children all over the globe, but especially for those who had been in captivity. One of the most well-known prisoner of war stories from the Pacific War is that of Louis Zamperini, the Olympian turned airman turned POW, who inspired the bestseller Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand and the blockbuster film of the same name. Louis's time in captivity saw him starved and tortured, especially by a Japanese guard nicknamed the Bird. But the way he realized the war was over was something he could never forget.
It was a beautiful day. We were suspicious. You see, there's always rumors the war's over, so we didn't believe anything. But this one guard came to me and he said, a horrible thing happened in a city called Hiroshima. A cholera broke out, and nobody can communicate with the... was Hiroshima. And I thought, cholera, my God, how horrible. I'm glad we're hundreds of miles north. But that was the first atomic bomb, and the Japanese lied to the public. Mm-hmm. But then when the second bomb was dropped, they told the truth immediately because they had no choice. So that ended the war, and then a plane flew over, and we wrote PW on the roof. They circled left. And then the Bird disappeared. He knew the war was over before we did. He skipped out and hid out in the mountains for 10 or 12 years. In the meantime, a TBF flew over from a carrier and sent us the Morse code in red light, that the war was over. And we were in the river for the first time swimming. We always wanted to go in that fresh water to clean ourselves. They wouldn't let us do it. Mm. But then the day they let us do it, I thought, well, maybe the war is over. And so anyway, we came out of there, and the TBF dropped a long red streamer, and we picked it up, and on the end was a candy bar with a bite out of it and a pack of cigarettes with one cigarette missing. We had to divide both of those up with several hundred men. Mm. We had to form circles, and one cigarette. Everybody takes one puff, and so it goes around the circle. It was really funny, but we were serious. And then the chocolate, we got a little teeny sliver just to taste it. And that was it. Now, Commander Fitzgerald of the Perch submarine, he was in command, a highest-ranking officer with us, and he made sure that everybody got one puff of cigarette and a little taste of the chocolate. And then, of course, the B-29s came over and dropped tons of food on us. And instead of hating the guards, they were complaining about their families starving at home. So we gave them a lot of food from the bombers.
Well, your stomachs probably couldn't take that much anyway.
Well, the thing is, the commander warned the guys, you know, you haven't been eating good food. You've been eating seaweed and barley for years, and so take it easy on the food. Well, some guys were so hungry, they just, pea soup was supposed to be diluted with a can of water, and they would eat it straight. So some guys got diarrhea from that, but the smart guys just ate a little bit a little more every day until they got used to it. Yeah, I went to hell and almost got killed on the way home. You know, there was a bomber. We were supposed to fly to Manila, but socked in. I'm leaving Okinawa now. I'm gradually working my way home. We were told to land at Loag, a small city in northern Luzon, on a fighter strip. Stayed there all night. Next day, they gave us clearance to go to Manila. And we took off with this bomber full of about 40 prisoners inside. And the runway's too short. There was a berm on the end of the runway that they put there to keep the ocean from flooding the runway. And I was up there between the pilot and co-pilot, and I knew we weren't going to make it, and they did too. We hit the berm, bounced in the air, and settled so low that the white caps came through the bomb bay doors and got all the prisoners wet. And I thought, this is it. After all I've been through, I'm dead. And then the plane gradually pulled up. We got to Manila. Now, a couple of years ago, I got a call from a fellow in the East, and he asked me how I got to Manila. When I told him about that bomber taking off, he said, well, I was the pilot, and I almost went in my pants. So, yeah, anyway, that's really funny. Yeah, so anyway, I got home, and of course, big celebrations, and I had a ball, and then I finally got married.
You probably know the rest of that story. If you don't, pick up Unbroken and read it, or link to Louis' interview at hometownheroesradio.com. He gave you a feel of what it was like for a prisoner, but how about being one of those pilots delivering aid to men who were about to experience freedom again? One of the men who can tell that story is PBM pilot Irvin Cooper.
The war was winding down, and we heard about the atomic bomb. Strangely enough, the Japanese military would not give up. They were determined, and they had every man, woman, and child in Japan told them, when the Americans invade, whatever you do, you try to kill somebody. Little kids with sticks, stones, guns, whatever they could have. I was at a place called Ulithi, and I saw 5,000, I'm using the word 5,000 because I don't know how to describe it anymore, of ships of every kind, from battleships, cruisers, to tankers, to ships holding supplies, water, men, and all that ready to invade, a million men ready to invade Japan. And they were just standing by. And the atomic bomb went off, and the Japanese said, no, we're not going to do it again. So they did the second atomic bomb, which was at Nagasaki. And I understand the Japanese generals and all still refused. It was Hirohito himself who stepped in and said that enough is enough. But had they invaded, they would have lost, I don't know how many men they would have lost, but they would have lost millions of Japanese people, too, at the same time. Anyway, the bomb went off, and we heard about it. And we were on a patrol, just a general patrol, whatever things were left over and stuff. And we were flying along. They gave us an assignment to go to, and I don't remember the name, prisoner of war camp, where a group of Australians were all in captive. And when I went to the plane, instead of having bombs on it, we were loaded with chocolate, with supplies for toothbrushes, teeth, oh, everything you can imagine, care packages galore, and little parachutes. And when you get over there, I want you to drop this stuff over there. So that was our mission. As we were going along, I think I was flying, and Amos was the navigator at the time. He says, hey, we're only about a half hour from Nagasaki. So we were free, and we flew over and got to Nagasaki. There was two valleys there. Japan is so green and beautiful from the sky. I remember flying along the coast and saying, I got to bring Elaine back to see this. This is unbelievable. The agriculture from the top of a little mountain down to the bottom was all just immaculately done. And we go over this beautiful valley, and the other side was completely browned out, like you could see streets in there and nothing. It was a concrete building that was sagging in the middle of it. And we flew around that thing. And sitting in the plane, I was holding, as we did, we were holding our crotch, if you'll excuse us, because we heard of this word we'd never heard of before. Radiation. What kind of word is that? Never heard of a thing like, well, it's the radiation will come. If it hits you, you won't have kids. You won't have anything. So here we are flying with our hand over our crotch, our hand on the wheel, and we're tipping around flying. We better get the hell out of here. So, and we took some pictures of it there, and we left Nagasaki. We flew over the Japanese camp. Apparently, the people that ran the camp, the Japanese soldiers or whatever, they just took off and left the prisoners there. And we dropped our supplies, and I have a picture of the prisoners coming out, taking off their shirts or whatever they had, and they wrote thanks on the ground that you can see. So that was quite an event.
The late Irvin Cooper, a PBM pilot, remembering the end of the war in the Pacific 78 years ago this week. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll also find a two-part conversation with Bill Overmyer. Bill had been captured on Corregidor near the start of the war in the Pacific. VJ Day meant he would be a free man again.
One day after work, the commandant, who was, we found out that he was a principal at the high school, and he spoke a little English.
Uh-huh.
And we went into the mess hall, just the officers and the non-commissioned officers. And he got up in front, he said, "Peace is smiling." We said, "What'd you say?" "Peace is smiling, goo. The war is over, goo." Hallelujah. That place went up in smoke. He said, "Don't tell the men. Keep it quiet, please." We said, "Yes, we will." Until we got out the door. And we told everybody else as quick as we could.
How do you keep that news to yourself, right?
Anyway, then here came B-29s. "What the heck are they doing this close? Oh, they're dropping parachutes. Oh, that's a 55-gallon drum. Oh, it dropped right in the rice field right outside our camp. A camp of 55 drums of cocoa. 55 drums of sugar, lard, anything else." And boy, we started eating like you can't believe. And I slept next to Cy Serrata. He was in the 31st Infantry at Yokohama. Right, I could touch him every night on a straw mattress. And he had gone with us, of course. He was up on a roof. One of those 55 guns hit him on the head.
Oh.
Survived 3 years, and he got, at least he didn't suffer.
So they're dropping supplies to try to keep you alive, and it kills him on the roof.
The chute didn't open.
Wow.
That didn't happen very often, but it did happen.
How tragic.
But it did happen. I think I was lucky. I was fortunate in the outcome of everything that happened. Mainly, I didn't stick my neck out. We had a saying in camp, "Don't stick your ears out or anything out and do anything contrary to what the Japs don't like or do like." So that's what happened. And I didn't, you know, the Army term for seeking approval from a higher up. We didn't do that.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Anyway, we did what we had to do to survive. And you just take it day by day. I learned at Yokohama how little it takes to survive, to live, day after day. You need food. That's a question mark. You need a roof over your head. You need clothes to survive against the elements. And maybe friendship, there wasn't that much of it. But books or peace of mind that you could manufacture or whatever, that's about all you need. You don't need all this fancy living. When we were liberated from Sendai, we got on the train. And we got the same train that brought us down, and we went up to Yokohama train station. We'd passed it every day, twice. And there was American soldiers, officers, and nurses. We saw our first American nurses and workers and so forth. They sure look good, I'll tell you.
Things that could easily be taken for granted no longer were for those who had survived in captivity, not knowing if they'd ever taste freedom again. And the way the news of Japan's surrender was communicated worked out a little differently depending on where prisoners were being held. George Heimbuch had questioned whether he would make it through and whether he would ever see his brother Ray, who was also a prisoner in a different camp.
We took over our own camp when we found out that interpreters said that there was a truce. Well, we knew there was no truce. We knew it was over.
Right.
So we took over the camp. And we went out on forays, you know, and
Yeah, I hear you even stole a train full of sake at one point, which is a story in itself.
Yeah, we got a truckload of sake of those in the 5-gallon jugs, you know, with those straw around it. They loaded the truck up. Two guys found it. I didn't find it. Two other guys found it. But they brought it into camp, and we had all canteens filled with it when we went on the train. They said, this train don't go to Yokohama. And Papinello said, yeah, he said, you get ready to go to Yokohama because that's where we're going. And you know, he was on the key, you know, and they took us into Yokohama, right?
You're liberated, and you're thinking, I'm going to get to go home, and I'll find out at some point if my brother's still alive or not, if he made it through the war as a POW. And tell me about how you bumped into him.
Well, we were in a tent. All of us were in tents, and I asked around, and nobody knew anything about my brother. Mm-hmm. And they had a staging area that where they announced guys that were going to leave that day. So every morning at 4, I'd get up and go down there, see if they announced his name, see? And he did the same thing, see if they announced my name. And there was a ditch there full of water, and they had a plank across it. And one morning I went down there, and it was raining. It was pretty miserable. I come back. And I stepped on that plank, and somebody was on the other end. And I said, excuse me, and I stepped off, and he said, George, there's my brother.
The guy that you asked to get off the plank was your brother.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty big hug right about then.
Yeah, that was a big meeting. Yeah, we had a good time there.
An unforgettable moment made possible by victory over Japan and the end of World War II 78 years ago this week. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, a story you may not have heard about the last mission. It's the subject of a great book by that title and opens our minds to so many what-ifs. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special VJ Day edition of the program marking 78 years since the relief, the elation, the long-awaited end of hostilities in World War II. One of the most fascinating VJ Day accounts we've heard over the years on Hometown Heroes revolves around the last bombing mission of the war and the alternate version of history it may have prevented. We'll hear about that from one of the pilots of the last B-29 to drop its bombs on that final assignment. But let's lead into it with the events from 8 days earlier. Our most recent episode of Hometown Heroes featured the last surviving member of the squadron that dropped the atomic bombs. They were flying from Tinian while Roger Jensen operated off of Guam. And he saw something out the cockpit window of his B-29 called Horrible Monster that no one had ever seen before.
On August the 6th, Colonel Tippetts and his aircraft, the Enola Gay, was stationed at Tinian and dropped the first bomb. And we were returning from a mission from Japan when they dropped that bomb, and we saw that the smoke and debris in the, from where we had dropped our bombs of course, at a different location.
Right.
We were headed home, but we could, we failed, you know, and so then we said, look over there, and there was all that debris, that smoke and stuff.
And you didn't know what that was, right?
No, we didn't know at that point.
So that had to be, I'm just assuming you'd never seen an explosion cloud like that before.
No. But it was announced to us before we got back to Guam that it was an atomic bomb, and boy, we were elated to think that we did have the atomic bomb and had been authorized to utilize it. The Japanese didn't respond with any surrender, and it was about 3 or 4 days later dropped in Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Nagasaki, we were assigned to fly another mission, even though that we wondered certainly they would surrender. I mean, they had been offered. And so they assigned us to fly a mission to northern Hokkaido, which would be the longest bombing mission we had from the Marianas by the 29s that had been flown. We were assigned to be in that group to fly that mission. So we put on extra fuel, and we weighed more than we ever had on any other mission. We had to reduce our bomb load to accommodate additional fuel to be able to fly that extra distance. One of the weaknesses of B-29 was the engines weren't good, and so we'd lose some planes because they just couldn't get off, just couldn't get going. And our airfield that we had on Guam was situated so that at the end of the runway, there was a cliff. And from that top of that cliff to the ocean was about 75 feet. And so we, as soon as we got to the edge, we went down, to get speed up to fly. And so we were in the number two position to take off that day. We were right behind the theater. And as we started down the runway, there was two runways we used, and there was a plane that would take off every minute on each runway. So there was a plane taking off every 30 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and there was probably 125 or 50 planes destined to fly that mission. Well, we had an engine that was not operating correctly as we started down the runway, so we aborted and went back to our stand. And so we said, well, we guess we don't fly that mission. But the ground crew got it fixed. And by the time they got it fixed, the last plane that had taken off for the mission was about 15 or 20 minutes anyway. And so we asked them, do we take off or do we stay here? It's up to you. If you want to stay, okay. If you want to go, go. We said to go. So we went, and so we were the last plane to take off. So we were the last plane to drop that bomb load, and that bomb load was dropped. We dropped our bombs less than an hour before Hirohito accepted unconditional surrender. And so we were the last plane because of that situation of our takeoff time to be the last plane to drop a bomb in that mission, which was the longest mission that was flown, combat mission out of Marianas in World War II. We were the last plane to drop the bomb on Japanese land. So we got word about an hour after we had dropped that one that Hirohito had accepted the surrender.
So you're on your way back. And for people to understand, when you say the longest mission, so you're going from Guam all the way to the northern end of Japan.
Which was Hokkaido was is the area. It was the last only oil-producing drilling field that Japan had. That was the reason for the mission. Mm-hmm. They said we found out different later, but that's what they told us.
Well, there's a lot you found out later, and I want to touch on that. But so we understand how long this was. How many hours?
17 hours is the longest mission. We were 17 hours from takeoff to landing.
That's a long time. But you're on the way back
yeah.
from dropping your bombs, and you hear on the radio Yeah. Japan has surrendered?
Yeah.
That's a pretty unique place to be to get that news.
It's a good place to be any place when you get that kind of news in that circumstances. So everybody on the crew went to sleep, except me. I never did sleep on the plane. Other people could sleep when after we dropped the planes and headed back home. And, you know, it was tired. Our average mission was about 12 hours, 12 to 13 hours. Mm-hmm. But this one was 17, and so I just didn't feel comfortable about sleeping, and so they could always figure I'd be going. And had a wonderful crew and a flight engineer. All of our crew members were well experienced people. They weren't recruits, so it was really wonderful. You have that kind of support and ability that you had in your crew. And so anyway, that was the experience we had up to the time of surrender. Then what happened during that last mission at the Imperial Palace, we didn't know about that. That was secret information and was never divulged for 40 years. And at the end of 40 years, we were told what happened at the Imperial Palace during up to the surrender deal, that we were so effective, were part of that, not knowing it, for 40 years.
So for 40 years, you know you have the distinction of being the last crew on the last mission of the war.
Yeah.
But you don't know that without you guys flying over Tokyo, that the surrender might not have happened.
Yeah.
What did they tell you 40 years later?
Well, they didn't tell us anything. I mean, it was just made public or made available. The radio operator on my first crew wrote a book, The Last Mission, Jim Smith, and he wrote the first book on what happened on that last mission.
So help us understand the significance of that, of why the path of your mission actually affected whether or not the surrender happened.
Well, the radar system that Japan had picked up the fact that here were B-29s coming in towards Tokyo. They were afraid we were going to drop, another atomic bomb on Tokyo or on the Imperial Palace even. What they did then, they blacked out the whole area, including the Imperial Palace and so forth. All of the personnel of the Imperial Palace, including the Emperor, were in the dark, and most of them were in shelters. Herr Hayato had decided that he would accept unconditional surrender. But he never talked to these people directly. It was always recorded. He'd record, and they'd pay the recording, but he never would personally talk to these people.
Would never be a live broadcast. It was always done ahead of time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the recording that was made of the surrender was done at early evening. There was a group of the high command group of Japan that didn't agree with the emperor about surrendering. They wanted to keep on going. And so they figured that if they got a hold of that recording that was down in someplace in the Imperial Palace, they could destroy that and the people wouldn't know about it. And they would hold the emperor under control, prison, I guess you'd say, or under arrest, so to speak. Being that they had to block out, there was only light they had was flashlights they could use, and they tried to find that. Often they tried to go to the radio station where it was recorded to the people, and they didn't know where it was. And others that did know didn't tell them. I mean, they just didn't tell you. So they did capture the Imperial Palace personnel and imprisoned them, separated them out so that his message wouldn't go out to his people. Well, there was two groups, and so the group that wanted to surrender were strong enough to avoid the other group that wanted to keep on under control. So they lost their support, and the leaders of that committed suicide at that point. So at daybreak, shortly thereafter, I believe, the recording was put out, and it was unknown whether the people would accept what the emperor said. And one of the conditions that the surrender did offer was that Herr Hayato would not be killed. But anyway, he made they played the recording, and the people of Japan accepted what he said. Just amazing how he could control those many people of something that was so adverse to what he was asking them to do.
Yeah, because up till then, it had been an honor to die for the emperor.
Yeah, that's right.
He was a divine figure.
Afterwards, we found out they had a lot of kamikaze planes that they had stored. Some of these people just thought they could beat us with those kamikazes. And interestingly enough, years later, when I was out of the service and in business and selling merchandise that I'd raised in Japan, I was dealing with a person over there when I was over there selling citrus. We talked a little bit about that until the surrender and so on. He says, well, I was a kamikaze pilot.
Really?
Yeah, and here was a guy just like you and I were sitting and doing business with, a nice guy. And I says, how come you would agree to that? He says, that was an honor to die. He says, there's no question of you. You just don't turn that down. Anyway, back to the surrender. It was totally accepted. There wasn't an active resistance to the emperor's surrender.
But if we add it all up, if you and all those other B-29s hadn't been flying that mission, which some people might say, hey, it was unnecessary, they're already going to surrender, you don't need to get that oil field.
Okay.
But if you didn't, those guys might have been successful in stopping the recording from being played, right?
Could have been, yeah. And Russia was supporting Japan, and yet Stalin was with Churchill and Truman, and Russia wanted, in the spoils of the thing, to have part of Japan, particularly up the areas where we, up in northern Hokkaido. But we didn't know that. We found that out later. But that's the reason that we had that mission, was to keep Russia from getting that when we knew that Japan was going to surrender. We didn't want Russia to have that property up there.
So it wasn't so much to take the oil away from the Japanese, it was to keep the Russian, the USSR's hands off of it.
Yeah. Well, and off of the land.
Right.
See, they owned up to it. They were just going to expand their ownership of properties.
When you learned all of this 40 years later about that unknown consequence of that last mission, was that kind of mind-blowing for you?
Yeah, it was. We just, it made sense to us after they told us about that, but we had no idea about why that happened. So that was, there was nothing heroic about that. It was just part of the deal.
What a story, and what a man. Roger Jensen will celebrate his 103rd birthday next month, but on August 14th, 2023, he joins the rest of us in remembering a day that should not be forgotten. Victory over Japan, yes. The conclusion of the most devastating conflict in world history, absolutely. But also, the chance to set a new course for the world, to pursue a new vision. That mission remains unfulfilled almost 8 decades later, but perhaps we can have an influence on that. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.